Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the House of Pod, a show where we pull back the curtain on the world of medicine, we answer questions about your health, and we interview great guests.
I'm Joe, and I'm not a doctor.
And I'm Lizzie.
I'm Kaveh.
And we're two gastroenterologists.
What's a gastroenterologist?
You know, the doctors who work with your digestive system.
Say what?
You know, your liver, your pancreas, your intestines.
Where now?
Your butt, Joe. It's your butt.
Oh.
Hey everyone, it's Kaveh from the House of Pod. This episode was actually recorded a couple months back. We had to shelve it for a little bit because of all the coronavirus stuff we were addressing, but it's more important than ever that we do it now. It's about physician suicide. Our guest is Dr. Michael Myers. He's a psychiatrist who studied and written about this pretty extensively. You've probably already seen the headlines of doctors either committing suicide or feeling under immense amounts of stress. And if we don't find ways to address this, this problem is going to become even bigger in the future. And the first step is to talk about it. So stay tuned. It's an important episode. And as always, if you want to reach us, find us at hopquestions@gmail.com. Find us at Twitter at the House of Pod. We're also on Instagram and also on Facebook. Looking forward to hearing from you guys there. Stay tuned. Back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
That was Julia Child. This is Lizzie.
How are you, Lizzie? How are you? How are you?
I'm good. Julia Child and I are well, she's dead actually.
Yeah,
sorry.
It got dark quick.
We should probably restart.
We are going off the rails. This is like watching Trump give a press conference on windmills or something. It's rough.
Oh, God.
So we actually have a guest coming up, and I guess we should give maybe a trigger warning. We don't do this very often, but there's going to be a lot of talk about suicide. And we're going to talk with a doctor, a psychiatrist, Dr. Michael Myers, not to be confused with the Michael Myers comedian or the stabby stabby horror film Michael Myers, but a great psychiatrist who studies physician health and has talked and written and studied a lot about physician suicide. So we're going to be talking about that. It might get a little dark at times in typical House of Pod fashion.
It's mostly fact-based, so yeah. Hopefully it's interesting. You know, we don't have a ton of data, but we try to keep it to the facts. It's not a tearjerker.
I think you're going to like it. It's serious. It's an important one. I think if you are in the medical field in particular, or you have a loved one who is, you definitely need to hear this episode. So stay tuned for that. A shout out to our friends on Twitter who have submitted questions for this episode. Please keep doing that. We'll put out upcoming guests so you guys can give us your questions. They're great. Thank you to Rebecca Watson over at the show Quizotron. I was a guest on her show for here at SF Sketchfest. That was a ton of fun. Please check out that show. It's so much fun. It's this science-based comedy quiz. It's really fun. Check those people out. Stay tuned. All right, on today's show, we have Dr. Michael Myers, professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. He's a specialist in physician health, and he's the author of the book, Why Physicians Die by Suicide, Lessons Learned from Their Families and Others Who Cared. Dr. Myers, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Myers, you're a specialist in caring for physicians. And as a doctor, honestly, I'm not exactly sure what that means. So what does that mean for you? Did you have extra training? Is this just your passion and you fell into it? Can you tell us a little bit about that background?
Yes, thank you. You're right, because it is a self-designation.
Oh, okay.
I'll tell you where it comes from. Is that I'm going to try to do this quickly. I lost my roommate to suicide when I was in medical school. And he was another medical student, and I didn't realize it at the time, but that sparked something in me that I obviously had a deep caring for my colleagues in medicine, because it never made sense to me why Bill killed himself. It still doesn't. When I finished my training, I always did half-time private practice and then half-time academic work for 35 years. And in those early years, I began to get increasing numbers of doctors referred to me for care. And so what I decided to do then after about 15 years, I was so busy as a generalist that I decided to restrict my practice to only looking after medical students and physicians and their family members. And so that's how I ended up getting so much experience. And so it just all sort of built from that.
Yeah. That's so interesting that you were driven by that real experience, and it's an inspiration. And yet also you developed this passion and love to take care of doctors, because for me, and I don't know if I can speak for Kaveh, but when I see that someone on my patient panel is a doctor.
Oh, they're the worst.
I get like a little terrified because I'm worried it's going to be like an inquisition. I know, I gotcha, you know.
This is why I've taught courses on treating physicians and their family members over the years, because that is a very common sort of thing for all of us who are clinicians, that it's a bit intimidating, you know, when the person opposite you, you know, is a physician. And so I've always enjoyed kind of helping, well, primary care physicians and other specialists too.
Yeah.
Because the bottom line is that I never want us as patients to fall through the cracks. Mm-hmm. Because I really feel that, you know, we obviously deserve the same level of care or exemplary care as that same physician would give to somebody who wasn't a physician.
Right, right.
So starting
sort of with the basics, do we have a sense of the numbers of how many physicians die by suicide every year and how it compares to the rate of the general populace?
Right. So until about 1 year ago, and you probably read this all over the place, that 300 to 400 doctors in the United States die by suicide each year, roughly a doctor a day. And many of us who write and who give lectures, that's what we've been saying. But that none of us have really been certain where that came from. And so Dr. Christine Moutier, who's a colleague and friend of mine, who's the chief medical officer of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention here in New York City, and also somebody who, when she was at UC San Diego, was one of the deans there, very involved in medical student and physician well-being. They have taken that figure off their website because, and I would agree, that we really don't know. we don't know whether all of our efforts that we've been doing for so many years now are making a difference in terms of decreasing the numbers of doctors who die each year, or whether the numbers are like suicide numbers in general. You may or may not know, but the CDC just released, you know, their annual figures for this year that yet again, the overall rates of suicide in this country are continuing to go up. And that's been going up now for over 20 years. Yeah. And we don't know, and we don't know where we fall in that as physicians. What I can tell you, though, is that this ain't going away. Doctors are still dying by suicide, as are medical students. So our work is definitely not done in any sort of way.
So you're saying, so about a doctor a day, and what is your sense, or is there data that you could tell us and our listeners why that risk is higher for a physician than your average, you know, just non-medical professional?
Right. Okay. So when we break that down, we do have research on this, that our rates, for instance, of depression in both men and women in medicine are a little bit higher than men and women in general. Beyond that, though, like our rates of, by the way, I'm talking now about the precursors, the things that, you know, can drive suicidal acts or behavior in doctors. So one, of course, is depression. The other is substance use disorders. And my colleagues who are trained in addiction medicine and addiction psychiatry, basically their research shows that our rates of substance use disorders are really about the same as other professionals. So I don't know what to say about that. The point, though, is the other thing that puts us at risk of death by suicide is the fact that we know how to kill ourselves. One thing I wanted to share with you and people listening to this podcast is in my clinical work with doctors who are my patients, the ones who have built up a trusting relationship with me and will go into that dark place where they will share with me their thoughts of suicide, one thing I've been struck by is the rigor with which they have given this consideration.
Right.
Because they all say the same thing, that if I end my life, I don't want to blow it. I've looked after too many botched attempts in my clinical practice, and I want to be very certain that the method I'm choosing is going to kill me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's scary doing that kind of work with someone, but yet at another level, I feel very privileged that they've trusted me enough. And the corollary to this, which is a good one, is that so often those doctors will say to me, thank you. I being able to talk about with someone about this gives me hope that maybe I will not, I'm hoping I will not have to enact this.
Yeah.
That kind of working with you on this, maybe I will be able to come up with reasons to keep on living.
You know, it's so funny you say that, because it's just like this real pre-med competitive sort of doctor thing where they're like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right.
I'm going to do it the best.
Going to do the suicide better than anyone's ever done suicide before. I'm going to be top of my class in suicide. It's like they're overachievers in everything, including this.
Yes.
What are you finding is the most common form of suicide by physician? Is it pills? Is it guns? What are they doing?
It really varies. There's clearly are a cohort of physicians who use their medical knowledge to complete their death by suicide. We see doctors who die by gunshot injuries to their, you know, to their heart or their chest, or to their chest or their brain, or here in New York City, we certainly see doctors, you know, jumping from heights. And so there just are sort of other means that doctors use. But what the bottom line, though, is again, because of their knowledge, so many of their suicide attempts, though, are indeed lethal.
And
that's why, you know, in my branch of medicine and psychiatry, one of the things we always teach our medical students and residents is to take a very detailed history about a previous suicide attempt attempt, because that can help you gauge the level of current suicide risk.
Yeah.
With physicians, though, unfortunately, very few have a history of previous suicide attempts because they have actually died.
Right.
You know, by the So at one part of my narrative research, when I was putting together the book on physician suicide, and I'm continuing to do this, is to interview doctors who did not die, who did survive near lethal suicide attempts.
Yeah.
And it is such a privilege for me to be able to talk with them, because I'm able to learn so much about, well, first of all, their mental state at that point, and then how they're feeling today.
Yeah. And it reminds me of the football players who think that they had brain damage from chronic traumatic encephalopathy, who do very deliberately shoot themselves like in the chest so that they can preserve their brain. It's really remarkable how much thought people go into doing this stuff. And then along those lines, you know, you talk about all the research and how deliberate these things are. And we have a question from one of our followers on Twitter, Pierre Dulampins, a doctor. And he specifically says, are there reliable stats, or I guess any stats, on which specialties have higher rates? And, you know, and perhaps maybe you could discuss why that would be, because, you know, again, the research that people are doing, clearly their profession will inform that kind of decision.
Right. Yes, that's a very important question. What is commonly thrown around, though, are largely outdated data, but it was a very well-designed study there. But the four branches of medicine at highest risk for suicide were psychiatry, anesthesiology, primary care. And the fourth one is something there that they are, they're called community physicians. And I'm not exactly sure what that job description is, but it was the fourth. But even if we broke those down, anesthesiologists are also more at risk, of course, of substance use disorders, and especially opiates, or opioids. So, and then, as you know, then we get into that hugely complicated dialectic of whether this was an accidental overdose of fentanyl or whether or not it was intentional. And in my branch of medicine in psychiatry, we think that possibly there's two things that could perhaps contribute to our risk of suicide. The one is whether or not there is some attraction to psychiatry by individuals with underlying conditions. Like, in other words, you've experienced maybe depression or something in medical school, you've received treatment, and you felt that maybe this is a branch of medicine that I would study myself, et cetera, et cetera. The backside of that, and you people might not necessarily know about this, but there's actually very high internalized stigma in psychiatrists themselves.
I know
this from looking after so many psychiatrists in my private practice who feel so ashamed or fraudulent if and when I have to prescribe life-saving medication for them, like an antidepressant, for instance. So then that's when I try to use the analogy with other branches of medicine, you know, where I say, well, you know, I've heard of the odd cardiologist who has an MI. Or I know an endocrinologist who's diabetic, or I, you know, I have a friend who's an oncologist and he's battling cancer at the moment.
Yeah.
So I kind of try to use those parallels to just try to diminish that internalized stigma.
It's a smart approach. I mean, so many doctors have at baseline imposter syndrome. They just are constantly looking for a reason to doubt themselves. What better one is there than this, you know?
Right.
A follow-up follow-up question from someone on Twitter, from Jessica Maria McCauley. She's also a doctor. It's sort of related to this. Are the numbers for suicide actually higher in trainees, or am I just sensitive to it now that I'm 10-plus years out and have my head out of the sand? So is there a difference in when? Is it seem to hit all areas of medical training, from medical school, residency, attendings? Is there anyone that's at particular risk?
Ooh, that's a very big question. And I don't again, I don't have a good answer to that. We worry that some of the deaths of medical students, for instance, have something to do with their age. Like, in other words, we know from general suicidology research and studies that the rate of death by suicide in college age populations, and that goes up to about the age of 25, are higher, and then they drop a bit. So picture a young medical student, maybe not so much here in the United States, but certainly my research that has extended to both the UK and Australia, whereas, you know, people go into medicine right after high school there. In fact, I can explain that because I've been working with a very sad situation of a family in England where their young daughter died by suicide. And she had been diagnosed originally with depression and then more laterally bipolar illness. It was just so hard for her to accept at such a young age that she, you know, had bipolar illness. And even though she was well treated, you know, she just had so many catastrophic fears sort of about her future. They were professional. Will I be able to, you know, pursue my career in pediatrics? Or, am I going to be able to get married? Am I going to be able to have children? Mm-hmm. As I listened to the story when I interviewed both of her parents, it just seemed so sad to me that if she had been able to kind of get through this period of time, I think that she would have lived. You know, she would not have taken her life. I'm reminded, by the way, and you people may be familiar with the fine work of Dr. K. Redfield Jameson, the psychologist who lives with bipolar illness. And she said the same thing about herself, that when she was young, when it was first diagnosed in graduate school, it was so hard for her to really accept the diagnosis. Then as she got through it and got a bit older and she became, you know, a better patient and would stay, you know, on medication and everything, then she could accept the fact that, you know what, I can have a good life with this.
Yeah.
But that takes a certain level of maturity. And when you're in training, you know, it's so competitive. Yeah. And this is why, of course, we have to keep fighting the external stigma that exists in medicine, and to make sure that people who are struggling with these things, who are in training, that they have to be reassured that there's a place for them. You know, just hang in there.
Yeah.
You know, we'll get through this. And what I like to do, and I've done this in the past, I've introduced some with HIPAA guidelines, but I've introduced a young patient of mine newly diagnosed with depression or bipolar illness to an older physician patient of mine who is living with one or the other of those illnesses.
Yeah.
And that older person then can kind of be a mentor or role model that, yeah, that, you know, there is a life in medicine for you, and you can live with these illnesses, and you can be properly treated, and you can be, you know, a very good researcher, a clinician, or whatever it might be.
Yeah, well, that's a good technique. It sounds like that would make a lot of sense. And with what you said also is that psychiatrists are kind of embarrassed to admit to other psychiatrists that they are struggling mm-hmm. with depression or thoughts of suicide. Yeah. And Kaveh mentioned earlier that, you know, as doctors, we want to be the best at everything,
right.
You know, including, unfortunately, suicide to completion. But what do you think, I mean, either in your research or just what you think, you know, why is it that physicians seek help less often than non-physicians? Or do you think that that's not true? Because there's clearly a bravado and, you know, an intelligence, kind of arrogance,
that,
maybe.
What you've said is just so very important. First of all, one of the things that I found most chilling in the interviews that I've been doing with bereaved family members, I found that roughly 10-15% of the families I've interviewed who lost a physician loved one to suicide, their loved one sought no care at all.
Right.
And so, in other words, they've gone from wellness to illness to death. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that breaks my heart. It really does. I mean, I've been working in psychiatry for decades. To think that there are doctors, some of whom are dying of treatable illnesses. I have a lot of friends who are oncologists. I've asked them, I said, have you ever heard of a doctor diagnosed with cancer who didn't go to an oncologist at least once,
right,
you know, for an opinion or something? Yeah. They may have rejected, you know, chemotherapy or radiation or whatever. But
they got seen. At some point they were seen.
At least they went forward with helping to think that our culture, well, first of all, there's the internalized stuff that we own. But then our culture is such that they're terrified that they won't be able to maybe get through their residency, or they won't be able to keep their job. Right. They're not going to be able to get their medical license. They're not going to be able to get that license renewed. They're not going to be able to get credentialing. They're not going to be able to get malpractice insurance or things like that. And I know that some of those fears are unrealistic, but yet there's a grain of truth in those things. And those barriers are the things that many of us have been fighting. For instance, like to modernize and make acceptable the questions that are asked on credentialing applications and medical licensing applications. Because, you know, I'm fortunate to work in a state. There are about a dozen states where when we take out a medical license or renew our license in New York, there are no questions asked at all about our health. Whereas many other states, not only do they ask draconian questions, but those questions violate the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Yes.
You know, so basically what we're recommending for those states is a question something like this: are you currently suffering from any illness that could affect your ability to practice safe and competent medicine? If so, please explain. All right. And then they would have to do that. But at least it doesn't partition off something in psychiatry or substance use disorder. That's the one thing. Secondly, it's current. And so, in other words, you could have sought help in the past or whatever, that kind of thing. You're fine now. You don't need to say yes to that question. And so, I mean, that's just one example of fairness. And so that people don't need to be terrified to go to get treatment. I think the other thing we have to change, of course, and this is where I'm looking to today's medical students and residents, because many of them are writing first person accounts of things that they've struggled with. And they use the term vulnerabilities. They say, why can't we talk about our vulnerabilities in medicine? You know, why is there this emphasis always on perfectionism and always being, you know, the best? So
we have a couple of voicemails here, actually, for questions for you. Mm-hmm. The first one is going to come from Quadjo, who is the host of a podcast in Canada that we really like called Solving Healthcare. It's sort of like a sister podcast to this show.
Uh-huh.
And he has a question for you here. So let me play this for you.
Hi, guys. This is Quadjo Caramanting of the Solving Healthcare podcast. And first of all, I want to say thank you for tackling such an important issue. Second, my question is, with the increase in burnout and moral distress we're seeing amongst clinicians, is that translating to increased suicide attempts or ideation or actual suicides amongst us? I think that's an important question. The other thing is, any advice to help manage the moral distress and the burnout that we're seeing and amongst clinicians? I think that would be really interesting to hear your perspective on that. And last thing I want to say is, House of Pod, y'all are killing it. Super awesome podcast. I know up in Canada, more of us are engaging in the show. We love what you're doing. You all stay fresh and dynamic. All right. Peace.
That's very sweet.
Yeah, I love that guy.
Again, I don't think we have hard data on this, but as far as I'm concerned, it can't help but do that.
Yeah.
Because as far as we know, the rates of burnout, I mean, I read some articles that they're roughly the same, you know, and I know it varies with specialty.
Right.
Every so often you'll see an update that, oh, burnout, it seems to be decreasing in this group and that, which is great. I do like the new terminology of moral injury. I think it really fits. And again, it gets away from that fear that people have that we're blaming doctors themselves when this is clearly a systems problem.
Right.
Okay. So that's what I mean. It can't help but you know, put people at risk. In psychiatry or mental health, the thing that we don't want to miss is an unrecognized, undiagnosed, and untreated illness like depression and anxiety disorder, PTSD, substance use disorder, things like that, that we want to make a clear diagnosis and treat.
Yeah.
Because with burnout, you know, the approach is really, really quite different. It's more of a systems approach or, you know, so, you know, milder things.
That is his other question. And this is really important for everyone to hear. You know, is there any advice to help manage moral distress and this burnout, whatever you call burnout, we all know what it is. That's the end of the day when you just can't handle one more task.
Right.
And when you do handle that task, we've talked about it before on the show, you probably make worse decisions because you're not feeling the energy to use your brain and to call your colleagues and ask for help. You just make, that fifth CAT scan, that 10th CAT scan, you make the easy decision and that might not be the right one.
Yes, that's right. What I say to that is this, as everybody knows, I think in medicine in the US, there are massive efforts going on systemically in this country. There's work being done. However, again, people on the front line say, well, that's all fine and good, but, you know, I need to do something right now, or I need immediate changes. And so when we can get changes occurring right in the medical center itself, and this is why the ones, for instance, who have dedicated funds for the quote unquote chief wellness officer, those are new positions, new job descriptions that are overseeing all of that moral injury in so many health workers. That's all good as well, but not all places have that. So with that, then it boils down to the actual program and what is actually being done there. Is there anything there that's being done to, make this a more humanistic place to train, to work?
Yeah.
And again, there are a lot of recommendations there too. And, you know, at the end of the day, we know that burnout is basically the result of individuals feeling that they have no personal agency, that they have no voice, they're a cog in the wheel, and that nobody gives a shit about them, pardon my language. And so when you got that stuff going on, that's what has to change. Because for too long, doctors have been treated as workhorses. And, you know, that isn't working. You know, like there's too many doctors who have gotten sick or too many doctors who have died. And so that's why, you know, but as you probably know, people are cynical, though, about recommendations like yoga, meditation, ice cream socials.
People have researched that if you give a doctor a couple hours of free time, you think that they're going to be happy and healthy. But really what they end up doing is their inbox and their computer work when you do need to force kind of what you're saying, like social time with other doctors and your colleagues to form connections.
Right.
We have Joe. Joe has called in a question. We would like to have Joe participate because we miss him when he's not here. And these are always either diamonds or cow patties.
Or really rough.
We're going to play that for everyone now.
Okay.
Oh, hi, Dr. Myers. I've read several articles online about you and your approach to preventing physician suicide. It's interesting that most of these deaths are a result of multiple psychological factors happening at once. One factor I did not see much discussion on was regarding negative patient outcomes. As a non-doctor, I have to believe that every physician throughout their career will have patients who have a bad outcome, where something they did could have been done better, leading to self-regret. Do you see this as a major driver of physician suicide as well? And if so, how does a physician mentally deal with it, a bad outcome, successfully? Would love to hear your thoughts. Thanks a lot.
Wow, that was a really, really good question, Joe. So, for example, he's saying basically if physicians are having, throughout their career, they're going to have some bad outcomes where they feel they could have done something better, they have some regret. Do you see that as a major driver of physician suicide as well? And if so, how does one deal with it successfully?
That is a great question. And I would like to add on to that. Even if you're a perfect doctor, there's going to be, for example, a lawsuit. So that's, even if you've done nothing wrong, you feel accused, you feel guilty.
Yes. Okay. That's a very good question. And it's layered. But even if you, even when and if a doctor is not sued, though, just that sort of sense of that internal sense of making a mistake or error, wrongdoing, can be very hard, you know, on the individual. There's two things I want to mention there. One is our respective personalities. We vary a lot on a continuum as to how we can kind of cope with those kinds of things that are a part of our careers in medicine. That to err is human, that sort of thing. And so many of us are somewhere in the middle, you know, where you, of course you feel that, but yet you talk with others, you grow through the experience, and you get through it. At the other end are those individuals where, yeah, that all helps, but it isn't quite enough. And so that's when an individual can really benefit from actually talking with someone about that, a therapist of some sort. And you can feel a lot better, with that kind of care. The other thing, too, that I've noticed, too, I've looked after doctors, and I'll never forget looking after an OBGYN person who came to me after his fifth lawsuit. And he said, you know, I've coped pretty well with the other four. I've got good legal counsel, et cetera, et cetera. But I am really caving with this one. There wasn't really anything particularly different. And it wasn't because this was number five. It had more to do with other stuff going on in his life that were also, as he said, you know, I'm pretty wobbly these days. And what it was, he was living with some pretty serious marital difficulties. He had concerns about one of his teenage kids, and his father was dying. And so, like, there was a lot of stuff going on in his life that was affecting his overall, just his overall resilience. He was being especially hard on himself. And even he could see that he said, you know, normally, you know, I just don't beat myself up quite as much. But anyway, I was able to help him just through some very good psychotherapy. And he required a low dose of an antidepressant medication. And he got through this fine.
Yeah.
When or if, you know, you're dealing with something that just doesn't seem to be going away, and it's really, you're beginning to ruminate on it, you're having trouble sleeping or something like that, go talk with someone. It can just be so very helpful, because these are major assaults, these things in medicine, you know, a bad patient outcome, you know, unexpected death of a patient or worsening of a patient. In my branch of medicine, it's losing a patient to suicide, things like that. Go talk with someone. It can be so helpful and at times life-saving.
Yeah.
That's great advice. That is, I think, a great take home for all our listeners, particularly our listeners who are in the medical profession. Mm-hmm. I think you've given them a lot, and us a lot, to sort of keep in mind and hopefully spread amongst ourselves, you know, in the medical world. And I'm sure a lot of this goes for our friends in the nursing world as well.
Yeah.
So thank you so much. A couple of questions. Where can people find you?
Okay, so the best place is through my website, www.michaelfmyers.com. And I've got a lot of resources, on that website, and, you know, links to podcasts that I've done or I continue to do, or, you know, articles that I've published, and, you know, a lot of our can easily be accessed online and downloadable and stuff like that. That's probably the best.
And people can also find your book on Amazon.com for sure. And I'm assuming they can also get it from that same website.
Yes.
Well, again, thank you so much. I can't stress how important this is.
Well, I'm very grateful to the job. I mean, I'm so glad for the work that you're doing, because I think it's so important to get these messages out there.
Yeah, and I have a feeling this probably won't be the last time we cover this field. So, what's
is there like a phone number or a hotline that you would recommend if somebody was listening right now and was struggling? Like, is there any sort of kind of emergency resource we can plug? The best one, of course, is the
Suicide Resource Center, and it's 1-800-273-TALK
1-800-273-TALK.
TALK.
Okay, yeah, we'll definitely post a link to that.
Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Okay, and thanks for both of you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
The opinions on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.